Good morning. Mark Trahant has been the University of Alaska Anchorage Atwood Chair of Journalism since 2013. He's finishing up his tenure with UAA this spring. Mark is the first Native journalist to hold the Atwood position, and he's reported on numerous Alaska tribal issues. I'm Lori Townsend, and on Talk of Alaska today, Mark Trahant is our guest as we discuss land into trust and what that could mean for the future of sovereignty in Alaska. We'll discuss Medicaid expansion implications for Alaska Natives, get an update on journalism projects Mark is spearheading, and take your calls on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Alaska Children's Trust, working to prevent child abuse and neglect by encouraging all Alaskans to take small steps that can make a big difference in the lives of Alaska's children. Information at alaskachildrenstrust.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Children's Trust. Alaska Pacific University offers a distinctive, personalized education grounded in hands-on, real-world experience that prepares graduates to be contributing members and leaders in their communities. This message is sponsored by APU. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Good morning. Welcome to Talk of Alaska. Today we're going to be talking about, well, a lot of issues, but first and foremost, we're going to discuss the advent of the possibility of Indian country in Alaska. My guest is Mark Trahant. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for being on today. Mark is a journalist, the author of books, including The Last Great Battle of the Indian Wars, and a media teacher and consultant. Mark, let's talk about this possibility of Indian country in Alaska and what that means. And for those of you who'd like to join our conversation, you can reach us around the state at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-8255. You can call in the Anchorage area at 550-8422, 550-8422, or email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. What do you think? Maybe we need to have a little bit of a kind of a explainer about what this means now that the Interior Department has made it clear that tribes in Alaska can apply to have land taken into trust, which would result in a legal definition called Indian country. What would that mean in Alaska?
I think part of it is to step back and look at how we tell the story about the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. And there are two conflicting narratives. One narrative is that ANCSA was a great termination bill. It ended the idea of Indian country and Indian reservations forever in Alaska, with one exception. And it set apart Alaska forever from the 49 other states. The other narrative is that the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act was a land settlement. And it just set that process in motion. And it did have some provisions that affected governments, created corporations, and did other things, but it was not a final arbiter of Indian law. If you look at the whole history of Indian law, the idea has been over the long haul that tribes are independent governments and that they predated the United States. And those two conflicting narratives are now coming to a head, where they're how we resolve those two different, very different worldviews will determine the future. I think a lot of folks thought that termination in the 1950s, which was a bill to end Indian reservations, and it started in Wisconsin primarily, Oregon and California, was the end of the road for those tribes. And you look back now and it wasn't. And they figured out how to resolve and revive. And so you're seeing that same thing unfold now in Alaska, where the tribes that thought government services had ended did not. What really pushed the debate forward was a couple things. One, the Obama administration has been very aggressive in taking land into trust, 280,000 acres since they've taken office, which is pretty remarkable, adding to the land base of tribes. And the second thing is the Violence Against Women Act and the so-called Alaska exception really put first and foremost in terms of the national discourse that Alaska had this big exception to the idea that federal Indian law basically carries.
Does the lessons and the legal precedent that was set after the termination efforts in the lower 48, does that case law provide sort of a legal guidance or pathway for Alaska tribes now?
I think it's going to be a political resolution rather than a legal resolution. And partly the reason for that is Congress goes through swings of pendulum of policy. And for example, when the termination era was at its strongest, they passed a number of laws that limited jurisdiction and did anything along those lines to end states or to give states more authority over tribal citizens. When termination ended as a policy, Congress didn't go back and reverse those laws. So they're still on the books, and it creates this really maze of confusing public policy. And now that's going to have to be sorted out both here and in the lower 48. That remains an issue across the board.
When you talk about not reversing those laws, does that mean then that tribal governments in those states don't have equal footing with state governments?
Exactly. For okay. example, there's a law in the books called Public Law 280 that makes state crimes a federal crime. And it allows states to take jurisdiction for public schools, highways, things like that. And that law was directly out of the termination era. It was about states taking more authority over tribal citizens, and it was never reversed. Mm-hmm. Some states have rescinded it on their own, but as a policy, it's still on the books.
1-800-478-8255 is the number if you'd like to call us from across the state. We're talking about tribal self-determination in Alaska and what the future might look like. My guest is Mark Trahant, UAA Atwood Chair for Journalism here in Anchorage. Also in the local area, the Anchorage area, you can call 550-8422 or email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Mark, what do you think the economic implications are for tribes if they successfully petition to have land taken into trust? What could this mean for the future?
I think it's going to be actually a series of negotiations because you're going to have to resolve how tribes will have relations with the state, how tribes will have relations with the regional corporations, village corporations, and others, and who's going to do what. And the corporate structure may be good for a lot of things, but in terms of basic governance, it's not something that's very effective. And so this will allow tribes to kind of figure that out. I think the answer will be different for different tribes. Some will come up with regional structures. Some will come up with direct governance just for a community. I think it's going to be a different answer.
Mm-hmm. Representative Don Young has said in the past that taking land into trust is something tribes here should not want because it adds federal regulatory burden. He said tribes wouldn't even be able to build an outhouse without a permit from and approval from the BIA. Is there any merit to this argument?
That's certainly one. In fact, the Senate held hearings just last week on that topic, and it was dealing with being able to take coal and develop it quicker. And the BIA and Interior does have a series of regulations that are often confusing. In terms of actually building an outhouse, I think that's hyperbole. I think that could be done with tribal regulatory structures. The BIA actually has been moving in the direction of supporting tribes for some time. And if a tribe comes up with its own regulatory structure, in most cases, that's what's going to survive.
What about the state? A lot of states have pushed back against this idea because of that equal footing doctrine that they were concerned about and some state governments fearful of. Should the state of Alaska support or be fearful of the legal authority that accompanies Indian Country designation?
I think if you look at the long history, the states that have been reluctant to partner with tribes have not had the same economic benefits that states that have worked closely with tribes have. And to me, the classic story is Washington. Washington State was often called in the 1970s the Mississippi of Indian Country. And the relations were about as bad as it possibly could be. And now tribes are an integral part of the structure. Tribes in the state work together. They have co-management on natural resources. They work together to improve the situation for their citizens. And that's the way it ought to be, is what government can be most effective at.
Mm-hmm. What is the difference between Indian Country and reservations?
Well, I'm sure there's lawyers that would come up with a technical answer, but I think essentially when the federal tribal status kicks in, where tribal governments have the ultimate authority, would be Indian Country.
Okay, so it's less an issue of, I mean, reservations have very clearly defined borders.
Right.
So if land were taken into trust, would that land be somewhat similar in that there would be a border that would encompass this particular area?
Right. And borders might be part of the discussion going forward, because not all land is going to be able to be taken into trust. And yet, if you do have an operating government, they're going to have to figure out where their jurisdiction goes. And that, too, might be part of the bigger negotiation.
When you say not all land can be taken into trust, what would be the differences? What are the distinctions there?
It has to be owned by either a tribe or an individual tribal member. So land couldn't be in trust that was owned by a non-member, for example, or a non-member corporation. Those would be kind of the distinctions.
Unless it were, if land was donated to a tribe by some other entity, they could apply to have that taken into trust.
Absolutely. Yeah, okay. And that's probably the way it would work.
1-800-478-8255 is our number across the state if you'd like to join our conversation today about the future of tribal sovereignty in Alaska. 1-800-478-8255. In the Anchorage area, it's 550-8422. 550-8422, or you can email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. You have written extensively about the termination era and ongoing efforts for tribal self-determination. What advice would you give to tribal leaders here who are thinking about petitioning for land into trust? What should they focus on for their own members and benefiting the future generations?
I think the big the lesson from history is to try to figure out how to be an effective government, and what are the best roles for that government, what's the size needed for that government, how to be basically creating an effective operation for justice, for some of the really basic things, child and family issues, public health, those sorts of areas.
We're going to look at a couple comments that came in on email here. This is from Mary Bishop in Fairbanks. And Mary says, in my opinion, tribal lands placed into federal trust will result, with resultant Indian country status, will result in a blizzard of litigation. As Ninth Circuit Judge Fernandez noted in the quote below, it will also result in an increase in the rural-urban divisiveness and will impede the obvious intentions of ANCSA. There are other ways to improve the domestic violence and abuse in rural Alaska. And so she lists a very lengthy quote here from Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals Judge Fernandez after he participated in the Venati decision in 1997. What are your thoughts about this idea that this would result in just a whole lot of litigation?
Certainly it's possible that litigation could come out of it. I think one of the problems with the structure as it's been in Alaska is that the state of Alaska has been a primary litigator against tribal interests for some time. And there's hope right now that this administration would change that and be more open to negotiation. I think in the end, the best way it's going to happen is a political process where everyone sits down and figures out what the scheme is that will work. And that would be a lot better to be negotiated rather than litigated. Mm-hmm. But it's hard to tell at this point.
The process for taking land into trust is not something that happens quickly or easily. Do you know much about what the process is when tribes, if they decide, all right, we've got this 50 acres, say, that we'd like to take into trust? What is that process? How long does it take, and what has to happen?
Because Alaska will be new, I'm not sure how long it's going to take. And the final regulations, they're still in comment form, so it won't even be available until after June. But the Secretary of Interior, which would mean the Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs, would have a process. They'd look at the land base, look at the history, look at the government role, and then make their decision.
Mm-hmm. So it will be June before the rules are in place, and then after that time, tribes could, perhaps they're getting applications ready right now, and they can just hit send after June.
Right.
Well, maybe we'll hear from some tribes. We also have another question here by email. Charles Bingham writes, you've written a lot over the years about some of the issues with tribal health care in Alaska and the rest of the United States, including some of the innovations such as the NUCA system of care at the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. The Indian Health Service has been greatly underfunded over the years. Now that the Affordable Care Act has been around 5+ years, there's been a clamor for the U.S. to go to a single-payer health system such as Medicare for All. If the country was to go this way, how would that impact tribal health care around the nation? Would a universal single-payer health care system eliminate some of the funding inequities that currently exist? And what he's referring to, of course, is, and this is something that I was going to get to, but we can talk about that now and certainly take questions and calls on tribal self-determination if people have other questions about that. The history of funding, as you well know, for the Indian Health Service, IHS, has been tribes. As the IHS turned over contracting to tribes and tribal health entities, they would negotiate for contracts. The tribe would say, it's going to cost us $28 million in the next year or 2 years to fund our health care system. And the IHS would say, okay, sign the contract, and then go to Congress and ask for, excuse me, maybe $18 million. Wouldn't even ask for the proper amount, much less have that amount allocated. The result was tribes were chronically running short of funds, and that would place them at risk with some of their vendors, and they'd lose good credit status. There have been a series of legal decisions now and large settlements, and the hope is that that period of underfunding, contract underfunding, is now in the past. That remains to be seen how this will go going forward. But what's your thought about Charles's question about a single-payer system and how that may impact all the entire healthcare network?
Sure. And there's actually an interesting transition from sovereignty, because in Alaska, the Alaska Native Medical System is a great example of sovereignty at work. It's 100% run by tribal consortia, and the Indian Health Service is only a funding agent, which is not true in the rest of the country. As far as the underfunding, the Indian Health Service is completely underfunded and has been from its inception. The agency was created in 1959, and when it was originally created, there was a doctor who resigned from the old Bureau of Indian Affairs Health Service and said, all we need are good doctors, good pharmaceuticals, and good facilities. It was pretty tragic back then, and it actually improved over the years pretty substantially. And I think Indian Health is one of the real great success stories in terms of how the federal government has managed things. That said, the funding has been remarkably short since its beginning. And what that has done has made the Indian Health Service be very creative in how it approaches medicine. And the good part of that is for the country is the rest of the country needs to learn that lesson, because we can't afford the system we have. The average IHS per patient cost is south of $5,000 per patient. Medicaid, Medicare, around $9,000. So there's a huge gap. If there were a single-payer system, I think Indian Health Service would come out way ahead, because they're already pretty efficient and would allow people just to follow the money, basically. What makes IHS work particularly well is that it's a system instead of an individual set of doctors. In the United States, most of our health care is sporadic. So if you get something that's chronic, you may see one doctor one time, another doctor another time, and those two doctors aren't communicating. And so they can't coordinate their response. Whereas if you go to the IHS in the Alaska Native Medical System, there's some coordination going on, so people know what you're doing and know what medicines you're taking, and can keep costs down that way and also get better care. And I think that would be the ultimate resort. The last study I've seen on underfunding is that if you look at all total costs, the IHS is probably about 60% funded. And so that extra push of 40% would be where it would actually improve markedly. In Alaska, the IHS is really only about half of the funding now. The rest is either Medicaid, Medicare, private insurance, or other sources of funding.
That's been a big change for Indian healthcare systems, is the prospect of taking private insurance and other methods of payment. I remember probably 25 years or so ago, working at the on the Lac-Couturier Ojibwe Reservation in northern Wisconsin, and having tribal members express frustration that had good jobs, and they would go into the clinic and say, "Look, I'll pay for my appointment because I understand that there's other people that really can't, and I want to be able to help." And they would say, "Well, we don't really have a system set up to do that." And it was a great source of frustration for friends who said, by the end of the month, the clinic's out of everything. They don't have any supplies because they run out of money, yet they don't have a system in place for taking money. Now that's turned around quite a bit. As you said, they're able to take private insurance. You mentioned the IHS as a kind of a funding agency for particularly here in Alaska, where things are run much more efficiently. Was that sort of the idea with both the IHS and the BIA, that eventually those services, those contracts to get that work done, would all be turned over to tribes, and the BIA and the IHS would diminish in size rather than growing, as especially the BIA has? Was that sort of the original thought, and we just, it kind of derailed?
Well, it actually hasn't derailed. It's actually become, over time, very slowly but effectively, the transition. For example, the BIA used to be the largest employer in Indian Country and no longer is. IHS had passed it long ago, and IHS continues to grow, but BIA continues to shrink. Right now, about a third of all American Indians and Alaska Natives do not have any insurance of any kind, and which is a huge number that the agency just takes in. And that, according to Kaiser Family Foundation, adds up to about $2.1 billion a year in uncompensated care. So it's a fairly large number that remains still to get. Where that came from is when the original Medicare and Medicaid passed in the 60s, IHS wasn't included. Congress didn't even think about how the Indian Health Service was going to be impacted by all of this legislation. And it finally came about with the Indian Health Care Improvement Act in 1974 that they allowed first-time third-party billing for Medicare, Medicaid, and insurance.
Let's go to the phones and hear from some callers across the state. This is Marlene in Deering. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. I had a question on our tribal government here in Deering, and I'm pretty sure others are not, like us, how do we get our powers and duties of our elected officials for our tribal and our village corporations revitalized, because some of our last 10 years at our annual tribal gathering, they said they're still using the 1950s powers and duties, and I don't know if they ever revitalized them. And how we have our election process here is we gather at the city building and elect officials by show of hands or a little scrap piece of paper. And a question I have, too, another one is the tribal organization in our rural Alaska, are they state or federally owned, and the Native corporations?
So you want to know about if the government structure for tribes is...
Yeah, how do we see the powers and duties of them? I have a copy made from when I went out of town about the powers and duties of elected officials, because I've seen some people get elected and not handed a piece of paper, powers and duties of elected official. They just run them how they think they run them, and it's not good for us. We need to rebuild our tribal organization. That's what my bottom line is.
Go ahead, Mark.
Thank you for the question. I think one of the ways to do it is to see what the governance structure is now. Most of the tribes in Alaska are constitutional tribes under the Indian Reorganization Act. So it would be to look and see what the governing documents are and what they say, and then to try to have community conversations about whether that still is effective, what needs to be changed, what needs to be made to hold people accountable for following that document.
So it just takes a little more structure in place and formalized on a tribe-by-tribe basis.
Right, right. It really does boil down to the tribe. My great uncle, who was, when I was a kid, I just used to spend a lot of time with and I really adored, his job was writing constitutions for the BIA, and he would travel around and write tribal constitutions. And his idea was that to take whatever inherent group of democracy ideas people had and try to fuse them in a document.
What an interesting position. There is an email question here. I'm not exactly sure what Tom in Fairbanks is asking, but he says, with the value of hindsight, what is your opinion on ANCSA?
Well, I think it's important to note that I think ANCSA could have been more attuned to the issues of governance. It really focused more on land and corporation status, and that, in hindsight, was probably its weakness. That said, it was probably the best deal that could have happened at the time. Mm-hmm. Congress wasn't open to experimenting. There wasn't a lot of really the big negotiation with ANCSA was over land and money. It wasn't over structure. And I don't think the will was in Congress was for anything different than that.
We have a caller on the line that maybe has a comment about that. John is in Anchorage. Good morning, John.
Hi, thanks for calling. Yeah, I did have a question about the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. I just wanted to maybe have you talk a little bit more about it, because it seems like ANCSA provides economic opportunity through the development of Alaska Native lands. It seems like this would slow Alaska Native Corporation opportunities for resource development, though, especially in areas where the federal government owns the surface rights and Native corporations own the subsurface rights. So I was just curious if you could talk a little bit more, and I was curious what the Department of the Interior said about this.
So far, that really hasn't been an issue that the Interior Department has talked a lot about. They, I think, are more focused on smaller tracts of land that would be both subsurface and surface, and probably more focused on local economic development. I think it's an issue, though. I think it does have the potential to change the equation, and whether corporations want to go along with that route or not, I think is going to be up to them and how far they want to participate in such a structure. Because even the idea, because the ownership is going to be different of a tribe and a corporation, so a corporation couldn't just give its land to a tribe without having an issue of property rights. And so those are the kind of things that are going to have to be both negotiated and compensated.
I it would be great if someone from Fort Yukon would call in, because it's my understanding that the way the tribe and their corporation work together is that the tribe controls the land and just has a mandate for their corporation to engage in economic development initiatives and make money, but the tribe retains ownership and control of the land to keep it protected to a certain degree. And so maybe someone from Fort Yukon will join us and let us know a little bit more about how that works and how they're how they see that going into the future. We're talking about tribal self-determination today on Talk of Alaska, and my guest is Mark Trahant. We're talking about what will happen as tribes in Alaska are able to apply to the Interior Department after June, when the rules are settled, to take land into trust and create a legal designation called Indian Country. You can join our conversation. We'll be taking your calls and email comments as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend, and today we're talking about tribal self-determination, tribal sovereignty, and the future of tribes in Alaska and the prospect of taking land into trust once the rules are settled. You can join our conversation. Mark Trahant, UAA Atwood Chair for Journalism, is our guest today. We're talking about a lot of tribal issues. The number is 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-8255. In the Anchorage area, it's 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Mark, we have an email question here from Joel, who says, what would be the advantage and disadvantage for Alaska Native citizens with the creation of tribal reservations, especially if some tribal governments are either incompetent, dysfunctional, or even corrupt?
I've been around a lot of governments, and that category of competency and corruption can fit pretty much any government you want to talk about. People are people. I do think, though, that over the long haul, the best thing to do is to give people the authority to make decisions that affect their lives and then to hold them accountable for that. And when you have a system in place where you have no responsibility, it breeds ineffectiveness in competition or in competency. Whereas if you have a system and set, this is the standard, it's high, meet it. People often do. They surprise you.
You can vote them out if they're not doing what they're supposed to. We're going to go back to the phones. Elijah is in Anchorage. Good morning. Oh, well, Elijah is gone now. All right. You can join us if you'd like. 1-800-478-8255 is the number outside of the area, and in Anchorage, 550-8422. Mark, you're a big proponent of Medicaid expansion. Why is this important for tribes when they get health care through IHS, through Indian Health Service?
We like to think of IHS as the reason that the treaty rights are being implemented by the United States, and the government, in my case, Fort Bridger Treaty, actually promises health care. It's directly in the language. But the United States has never funded the Indian Health Service that way. Mm-hmm. And so we have a system that I think is very good, but one that's not funded adequately. Medicaid expansion is a way to increase the funding. We're already seeing it. I did a column just a week ago that looked at the numbers in Washington State. And Washington State is a Medicaid expansion. And one small tribe reported that it's hiring new people. It's putting into effect expansion of its clinic operations because of Medicaid expansion. It's getting this new revenue source that just adds to the pot. The way federal law works with Medicaid, with any third-party billing, is it stays with the local unit. So it actually improves healthcare delivery for people in that unit if they get that extra money.
Now, there were a lot of information campaigns that went out when the Affordable Care Act first came into being, and people were telling tribal members apply for an exemption, a one-time exemption. So how does that square with this Medicaid expansion idea?
Yeah, I think that was a real mistake that the both the Indian Health Service leadership and the Obama administration made, is to promote the idea of the exemption for Indian country, American Indians and Alaska Natives. And the idea is rooted in that we have a treaty right to health care, so we shouldn't have to go through that system. The logic is fine. It makes a lot of sense. But I would have much rather seen a campaign to get people with the insurance that they could get and to have them build the system up. For example, most of Indian country, because of the income levels, either qualifies for reduced insurance subsidies or Medicaid. And if you can get people into those two programs where they're not actually paying a lot out of pocket or maybe even nothing at all, that'll actually improve the system. And I would have liked to seen something that looked at the whole system rather than individual. But that was their choice, and that's what they campaigned on, is the idea of an exemption. And it is lifetime, so once you apply for it, you don't have to worry about it ever again. But it doesn't add any benefits to the system.
And it does seem like it would be a point of confusion for a lot of people as well, trying to figure out, okay, Medicaid expansion is good for the system, yet we're told that we should just apply for this lifetime exemption.
Sure.
Let's go back to the phones. Martha is in Anchorage. Good morning, Martha.
Good morning. Good morning, Mark Trahant. This is Martha Oakrickson. I first met you back in Canada when you were active in the nationwide journalist group. And I've enjoyed your work here at the university, and I had a couple of comments. I wanted to add to the discussion about healthcare. There is a consortium of 229 tribes that's actively involved in healthcare delivery here in Alaska. But there's also, because of the late Senator Ted Stevens and a congressional writer, there is part of the hospital system is controlled by a nonprofit, the South Central Foundation. So I think there are issues having to do with delivery of healthcare because there are two systems of delivery. And for example, in the maternity ward at the Native Medical Center, you have doctors and nurses. One group works for the consortium, the other group works for the foundation. So there is a joint operating board that oversees the hospital. The next meeting is this Friday at 9:30 in a conference room at the Native Medical Center. So I wanted to bring that up, and I didn't catch the name of the woman from Deering, but I understand that she's calling, I guess you could say, in a little bit of isolation. And just to put things in perspective, there is no longer an effective statewide Native tribal organization. So there is no one besides the BIA she can effectively turn to for help. She's probably dealing with the 1930s constitution, and it may still be effective, but there may be a local need for some help on what constitutes a tribal leader and what are their legal responsibilities. So that's what I'm taking back from her discussion about rebuilding tribal organizations. And then I did want to ask Mark if he could comment on the role of a couple of things, the role of the Native American Rights Fund in the 9-0 Supreme Court ruling that basically legally abolished Indian country here in Alaska. And then also if he could discuss what's going on at the university, just briefly, what's going on at the university with the indigenous community, and if during his tenure there, if he could leave a lasting legacy of an effective faculty, Native faculty union or group, because I do think that there is historically been concerns within the Native community about the largest educational institution here in Alaska.
Well, thank you, Martha. You've raised a number of interesting and important issues. So, Mark, have at it.
Thank you, Martha. That's really great stuff. Let me see where to start. First, I think it's really important that you talked about the difference with the Alaska Native medical system and how it is divided into. In some ways, it works because it's cooperative, but there's always issues when you have two organizations and two priorities and two systems. That said, it tends to be more effective than other parts of the country where you don't have that even communication. Since the success of the Alaska Native medical system, and it really is, when you look across Indian country, by far the best operating system in the country. But a lot of folks are trying to emulate it. For example, in the past 5 years, Navajo Nation, which has a very sophisticated tribal government with full operating facilities, decided not to do many of the same healthcare things through the government, but to do it through foundations because they saw the way that it was working here in Alaska, and it changed the equation just a little bit in terms of the role of government as a regulator versus the role of government as an operator. So that's the kind of thing that's still being worked out. As far as the 1930s constitutions, it really can be complicated and requiring an update, and it does require a long-term commitment to reform. A lot of tribes are going through that in the United States with constitutional conventions, constitutional reform plans, code updates. All of that is very methodical, and it takes a long time. And it really, I wish it would be an easy process, but there really is no easy way to do it. It's just something that has to be addressed step by step over a long period of time. As far as the Supreme Court decision, it did abolish Indian country, but the Supreme Court, I mean, it didn't end it forever. It ended it for the litigation that was up to that point, and then both Congress and the administration has moved forward since then. And that's where we're at now, with the administration particularly moving forward and finding new ways to define Indian country. The Supreme Court, it's interesting because both with Indian law and with Indian policy, there's this idea that when something big happens, such as ANCSA, it ends the dispute. And it doesn't work that way over the course of history. What happens is it becomes one milepost, but then the debate continues. And that's exactly what's been happening here. Congress continues to weigh in. The administration continues to weigh in. And the final way it's going to look is just undefined at this point.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mark, I think you've answered a question that we had that came in by email. Dick Lefevre writes in, "Hello, Lori and Mark. Can the NUCA model of health care delivery that was developed by South Central Foundation be a model for other regions and tribes, especially in the lower 48? And as you just mentioned, it sounds like the Navajo people are looking at those very things. And I seem to recall that there are other tribes as well that have come to study the system here in Alaska.
People from all over the world have come to study the system here in Alaska. And it's not just about the governance structure, but about how you treat patients. One of the things we grew up with is, it's kind of funny because I grew up with IHS during the Vietnam War. And when I was a kid, they used to joke that the doctors wore masks so you couldn't identify them later because they were there on draft deferment and really didn't want to be there. But the idea we mostly grew up with is you have to see a doctor. And that's just not necessarily true. Sometimes doctors aren't the best person to see either. You've got other priorities. And what works with NUCA particularly well, and more systems are starting to adapt this, is to put together a team approach and to have the patient be part of that team and to be coordinating care from a much broader, wider lens.
Well, and also having people take more responsibility for their own health and their own health care, being actively involved so that you're not just a passive participant waiting for direction from the doctor about what do I do and how should I do it. Okay. Let's go back to the phones and get Nancy from Ketchumek on the Nancy's gone. All right. Well, let's head down to Sitka then. We'll take a trip around the state here. We're going to Sitka to hear from Thomas. Good morning, Thomas.
Good morning. Listen, I just have a couple of questions, and mine are rather local in their nature. I'd like to know why Search appears to be winding down its operations at the hospital in Sitka. Are there financial problems, or there is a new model that they're trying to work under? And who would know about the plan? And where would they the services be relocated, and what services would be relocated?
Well, I think you've given us a question, Thomas, that we can't answer. Mark, I'm assuming that you don't have any idea what's happening with Search and their operations.
I'm sorry, I don't.
Yeah. Sorry about that, Thomas. Best to just go right to Search and take your questions there. Let's go to Jenny in Anchorage. Good morning.
Good morning.
You have a question for us?
Sure. So if this becomes a reality, is there enough Bureau of Indian Affairs or Department of Interior staff in Alaska to handle the number of land to trust applications, the impacts an increase in land ownership brings?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. I think it'll affect over time. When the Indian Self-Determination Act was passed, there was a meeting in the Senate, and Henry Jackson, who had just authored the bill, asked, "Do you think this is all going to happen at once?" And the Bureau said, "I think it's going to happen slowly. There'll be a few more, and then a few more. And that way you can gauge kind of what the staffing requirements will be." And I suspect it'll be like that with this.
That is a good question, though, and it seems like that is ripe for some reporting for us to examine. Are there efforts to build up the BIA staff here to take on that very issue that may be coming this summer with tribes applying? If you'd like to join our conversation, we are entering the final quarter hour here of Talk of Alaska. But there's still time for you to call in. 1-800-478-8255 is the number across the state. 1-800-478-8255 or locally 550-8422. We're talking about tribal sovereignty, tribal self-determination. Mark, we're wading back to the issue of Medicaid expansion and IHS. We're waiting for the Supreme Court to release its decision in King versus Burwell regarding the subsidies under federal exchanges. This is what Alaska has. If the decision goes against the federal exchanges, how big do you see this impact for Alaskans, and what will that look like?
Well, if it does go against Burwell, I think the Congress is going to be forced to act, because there's got to be some sort of way to come up with a solution on that. It's really important to note, though, that for the Alaska Native medical system, this decision will not impact it, mm-hmm. because Alaska Natives and American Indians would be what's 100% reimbursement from the federal government. So, which is actually one of the things about Medicaid expansion is, given the population we're talking about, roughly 20% and growing, that's money that the state will not have to spend, not now nor ever. It's not something that's going to change. It's 100% reimbursable rate. And so having that system, getting that federal dollars, improves and allows them to create jobs, allows them to create and hire more, and it basically will filter down through the rest of the Alaska medical system.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the phones, and we'll hear from Sean in Anchorage. Good morning, Sean.
Good morning. Thanks for having me. So if land is taken into trust, the federal government holds the deed, from a local control aspect, what would be the impact if a tribe or individual wanted to build like a new facility or store or like a business? It sounds like there'd be another layer of bureaucracy, like state and federal approvals and all that kind of stuff. Wouldn't that slow the process and add more red tape for rural growth opportunities?
It could complicate it, certainly, because if you had a local government and a tribal government both claiming the same jurisdictional space, that would have to be negotiated. If a tribal government was the primary authority, it wouldn't necessarily be more complicated, because once the regulations were in place and they were allowed to execute that, the federal government would go along with it.
So then it would just be more, it would just be more a relationship directly, even a more direct pipeline from tribes to the federal government. Would that be kind of a simplification of it?
The federal government would be basically in a role of supporting the tribal ordinance. So once the tribe came up with how it wanted to manage that land, the federal government would mostly try to be supportive.
All right, we're going to take one more quick break here during Talk of Alaska. And when we get back, we'll talk more about tribal sovereignty and the future of Mark's plans.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station. Alaska Pacific University emphasizes teaching and research that engages the region's social, cultural, environmental, and geopolitical issues. The university's Early Honors Program attracts academically advanced high school students who complete their senior year credits while also earning college credits as full-time APU students. This message sponsored by APU. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2015 Directory for Older Alaskans. To order the directory or learn more, go to SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend, and my guest today is Mark Trahant. He is the current UAA Atwood Chair for Journalism at the University of Alaska Anchorage. And Mark, let's move to a pre-exit interview with you about your time as Atwood Chair at UAA. Tell us a little bit about what you focus on, and how did that change or grow from 2013 until today?
Well, and I'm really grateful I had the opportunity to be two terms as the Atwood Chair, which is always, that's a real privilege to have been part of this experience. I really have to commend both the UAA and the students, just fabulous students, and I've really enjoyed working with them. My approach to teaching is to be a journalist teacher, journalist being the first word. And so I always practiced as I was going along and reported stories and got out and did things and really got a chance to see as much as I could in Alaska.
Mm-hmm. What I know that you wanted to spend time in rural Alaska. Where did you have much opportunity to do that, and where did you go?
Not as much as I would have liked. My most recent trip that I just had a blast with, working with students in Unalaska and talking to them about how to tell stories with cell phones. And technology is changing so fast, and there's this, again, I like these big narratives, and there's this narrative about journalism in decline. And if you look at newspapers and traditional media, you can certainly make that case. But I think with technology, we're now seeing journalism at the very beginning of something brand new. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's really exciting. And if I'm a young person, I'm thinking, this is the time to get into this because it's just beginning.
Well, I'm glad that you brought up cell phone journalism. I wanted to ask you specifically about that because you're a big proponent of that, employing it yourself. Why is that? Why is this an important part of your curriculum or your educational outreach when you're working with students?
Because we can all do it. We have access to things. The power of a cell phone now is basically the technology that was in a television studio just 10 years ago. And it's in your pocket, and you can do everything that you could do in a television studio or radio or even writing and picture taking. And that just puts it in the hands of people. And I think that's more democratic with a small d. It just spreads the ability to tell stories to a much wider audience. The kids, in fact, it was great. I spoke in Alaska to fifth graders on up. And some of the fifth graders got together and put together a video that they sent me that they already started doing what I was talking about. So it's really great to see.
That's fantastic. What will be your takeaway when you leave here? What do you feel like? I always think and feel that a good teacher learns as much as they're teaching. What do you take away from what you've learned from Alaskan students, both native and non-native?
I think the big takeaway is that Alaska is at a point where it's trying to figure out how to make the jump from a natural resource extraction state to something else. And I grew up in the rural West, and the rural West has gone through this. Montana and Idaho were once at that point. And sooner or later, folks have to figure out that the most important resource in the state is brain power. And in fact, if you look back at the turn of the century, two centuries ago, actually, the Idaho Constitution, where I'm from, actually set in motion the idea that we care so much about brain power that tuition will ever be free in Idaho. And it was put into the Constitution because they wanted people to move there and create things and to learn and to adapt. And future governments took that out. But that idea, I think, is something really powerful. That the most important resource any state has is who its young people are and what they're going to do with ideas. And that's where you see Silicon Valley created or ideas created. And I think Alaska has that potential. And it's just, again, at the very infancy.
Mm-hmm. Young people are definitely the way to sustain us into the future. There's no question about that. Let's go back to the phone for one quick call. Nick is on the line from Kodiak. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. Say, earlier in the program, Mark was talking about this negotiation that would occur between the state and the tribes if they had the trust land. But I thought it was more clear-cut than that. I thought that, for example, if a tribe owned the Captain Cook Hotel in downtown Anchorage, they would be exempt from state taxes, and the local enforcement, law enforcement, would not have any authority on what would occur, you know, in the hotel, whatever it might be. Or as far as fish and game management, if the Indian country land would be exempt from fish and game management, or even resource development, that if there was a trust land and they wanted to develop something like the Pebble Mine or the Chewetna Mine, that it would not be subject to the state environmental and permitting regulations. Could you perhaps comment on some of those things?
Thank you, Nick.
Sure. Absolute terms, that's basically the way is that the tribe would have the authority, not the state. That said, the best operations in the lower 48 are ones that are continually negotiated, where the tribe may start off with that authority and then figure out a scheme to make it work better, involving the state and local governments, so that it's not just by fiat, but by compromise and negotiation.
It just seems like no good can come from trying to operate in isolation when you've got neighbors and other government entities that could perhaps help out in some of these joint prospects, rather than just saying, well, we're just going to go our own way.
Right. Where you have tribes that have large contiguous land bases, they're able to do things differently than ones that have lands that are checkerboarded or other complexity. And Alaska would be on the side of complexity.
Mm-hmm. Well, we only have a couple of minutes left, Mark. So tell us what's next for you. You'll be wrapping up at UAA sometime in the next few weeks. Then what?
Well, I'll be doing some reporting in Alaska from the summer. And folks can find me at Trahant Reports on Twitter, or I have an app, Trahant Reports. And I'm experimenting with a couple of things. One thing I really had fun with recently was a video, a cell phone video, with the First Alaskans Institute on the next 10,000 years and looking at their story about how you define where you're going in 10,000 years.
Mm-hmm. And is that also available online that folks can find that? We'll link to your site and some of those things. But give us a little indication of what some of the reporting, I know that you've kind of mapped out some topic areas. What are you going to be tackling?
Well, I definitely want to keep pressing on sovereignty and what it looks like, and it's an issue I've been interested in for years, and the idea of defining or letting people define what works for them with government. And one way I've been approaching that is thinking about what does sovereignty look like? What's an example of a place where sovereignty works well, and why does it work well, and take it apart? And maybe the flip side, looking at where it doesn't work well and why. And exploring that as well.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also looking at a massive data project. I've been building data on the history of Indian spending in the United States.
Yes, that is of particular interest, and hopefully we can get you back to talk about that at some point in the future once you kind of delve into that and start mining that data. Thanks so much to my guest, UAA Atwood Chair of Journalism for Journalism, Mark Trahant. Thanks, Mark, for being here. Thanks to our engineer, Dave Waldron, and Josh Edge on the phones. We'll be back next week and talking about juvenile justice and substance abuse and the pathway forward for young people in the Anchorage South Central region. Thanks for joining us.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. And by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.